local communities. Sarah Cohen is a deputy head of mission at the Canadian Embassy in the U.S., where she focuses on foreign policy and national security. She says that for Canada, Arctic and defense policy starts with partnerships with Indigenous people in the North.
You can't have safe people without having a safe environment. You can't have safe people without them having a safe and secure access to a future that is characterized by dignity. In Canada, that's very much also part of our reconciliation with Indigenous peoples as we look to continue that journey, which is very much about truth and also reconciliation.
Arctic Encounter is running through Friday. It will feature discussions about policy, infrastructure, and Indigenous sovereignty. And on this day in 1763, Ottawa Chief Pontiac led a coalition of warriors against attacking British forces at Fort Detroit in the Great Lakes region. Initially started by 260 British soldiers, the natives were so successful in repelling their foes that nearby Parents Creek was renamed Bloody Run. Today, the site is now Elmwood Cemetery in East Detroit. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
So glad to have you with us as you're listening to the KBOO Evening News on this Thursday, July 31st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, James Kemp, and Eric Tegadoff. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Many participants at the Hague Group's recent emergency meeting in Colombia were talking about taking action against Israel's continuing war on Gaza. But some observers, who were closely following the actions of the various countries involved, note that many of them have not pushed for the legal approaches available, which include demanding an arms embargo and sanctions through the UN General Assembly's Uniting for Peace mechanism. Robert Jureski is a New York-based attorney who has led Code Pink's World Court Project. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about what can really be done to stop the Israeli assault on Gaza.
People all over the world have been trying to get this assault on Gaza to stop. There have been many appeals. Countries have spoken out. Politicians have spoken out. Activist groups are trying to do something. But you're saying that there is something that can be done in a very concrete way. Why don't you talk about that?
There are things that can be done by various actors, individuals, institutions, and then states. You know, the most important thing that can be done, or the most powerful thing that can be done, are by the powerful states that are arming Israel and continuing to provide diplomatic cover for them, continuing to describe this as a war, continuing to gloss over the declared intentions of the Israeli high officials and members of the military and their pundits on their televisions. The states can do something by stopping to provide help for Israel to carry out these plausible violations of the Genocide Convention, which the World Court found in its opinion a year and a half ago.
And so how close are we to seeing that? We know that certain countries like Spain and Norway, for example, have, and Ireland have spoken out. We know that there's even opposition in the U.S. Congress, although not that much. How close are we?
It's really hard to say. You know, everyone keeps pushing until the dam breaks. You know, everyone, you have to keep pushing and suddenly it will change. It's hard to say how close we are. You know, this conference that just occurred in Bogota a few days ago, the Hague Group, you know, a step in the right direction, a small step, unfortunately, but they provide a framework for states to join and also a time frame within which responses to their positions are expected. The reason I think it's just a small step, and they came out, there were 30 countries, and 12 of them signed on to the final position of six action points. The others, I'm not sure what they're waiting for, but I say a small step because, for instance, a lot of these actions that are being called for were called for in the General Assembly September 18th, 2024 resolution, a Uniting for Peace resolution. Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. It was a codification of the World Court Advisory Opinion from July 17th, 2024, which found that Israel, its occupation was unlawful, the practices, the policy, and that it had to end as soon as possible, the July 17th opinion. The codification, September 18th, by the General Assembly said within 12 months. So it's a small step that, what is it, 8 months, 9 months later, that, you know, that 12-month time frame that was set by the General Assembly has been used to say this is when we expect states to join these six action points or take a position on them. And the action points are basically calling for accountability for the serious crimes, violations of international law that Israel is committing.
So it doesn't matter that the UN is not really a democratic institution in the sense that the Security Council has most of the power to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, it has the power, and it not only has the power. I'm sorry. Did you say that the Security Council has most of the power?
Yeah.
It has the power and the obligation, and when it fails to meet its obligations to ensure peace and stability, then under Uniting for Peace, the General Assembly can take action and is empowered to take action, and has in the past. The Uniting for Peace resolution has been used on multiple occasions to impose sanctions, embargoes on, for instance, South Africa, apartheid South Africa.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to what extent South Africa can be used as a model for what's going on in Gaza, given that the situation was a little different. It was not a full-scale assault on the entire Black population. It was just a very oppressive system that had to be ended, whereas the Israelis are killing tens of thousands of people. But yeah. You think it's still kind of a model?
It's a model for what should be done and what should be done on an accelerated time frame, because the isolation of Israel, the isolation of South Africa happened over a long period of time, and yet it did succeed in changing that regime. Yeah, there are a lot of factors at play, but like you mentioned, the current destruction is unparalleled to what happened in South Africa. And so the General Assembly should be acting much faster and much, much more intensely. You know, Sam Husseini calls for a repeated introduction under Uniting for Peace of resolutions that would show where countries stood and would serve to isolate those that are recalcitrant in meeting their international laws, obligations under international law. So it would isolate the United States as well, and perhaps Germany. But, you know, Europe does really hang its hat, and so the European project is about the rule of law and creating a set of countries that are unified under international law, human rights frameworks. And the actions of the EU in failing to meet its obligations just really show up the European project. It really does reveal the bankruptcy of the EU. There's a trade association agreement with Israel where Article 2 is a human rights condition that Israel has to abide by. And there was a call for review by Ireland and Norway in November. There was a review. The results weren't publicized, but they were honest. And there was a finding that Israel had not abided by, or it was not abiding by, human rights obligations. And then in May, again, now a public, a majority voted for a review, and the review was conducted. And then Kaja Kallas, who's, I think, the foreign minister for the EU, she, and I don't know how she could be allowed to do this by the member states, but she basically made an oral agreement with Israel that they would deliver more humanitarian aid and that there would be no suspension of this trade association agreement, which is the power that states, the trade is what Israel is going to respond to. It's going to respond to its isolation in economic terms, and it's going to respond to its vulnerability militarily when countries say, we're not giving you weapons anymore. So, I mean, Kaja Kallas is really just, it's just atrocious how she has behaved and how she has made this agreement with Israel that sidelines the tools, just folds basically to Israel's interests, does not impose conditions. But all of that doesn't, even though the EU has this trade association agreement with Israel, each country within the EU has its obligations, the obligations under Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, that they have to take action to ensure respect for international humanitarian law. And so those obligations, obligations under the Genocide Convention, the Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, those exist for the ratifiers and the acceders to those countries that have joined that convention. So they should be individually, regardless of what the EU votes on or Kaja Kallas, the deal that she makes with Israel, they should be imposing arms embargoes, not allowing transshipment of arms to Israel, not delivering fuel. These are all things that each country should be doing as a matter of their obligations under international law.
So I guess you can't see a kind of Suez Canal situation happening where, of course, at that time, the U.S. is on top of the world and it can, well, in a sense, it still can dictate to the rest of the world what to do in this kind of situation. But you don't see the Trump administration acting like the Eisenhower administration and just telling these people to stop what they're doing. It's just too hard to conceive.
Reagan did it, right? I mean, he told Israel to back off in I think it was in Lebanon. Trump, Trump has the power. Supposedly, once in a while, he's upset with Netanyahu, and I think he's pretty much an emotional, instinctive leader. Like he says, he doesn't have a big framework within which all of his actions work, but he just is running.
Yeah, he gets annoyed if people don't follow his directives, but then he kind of forgets.
Yeah, and I think there are people who are fairly, who stay within administrations regardless of what party is in power, and the policies have been fairly consistently indulgent of Israel. It's not as if the prior Democratic administrations put any brakes on Israel, either on the settlement activities that they occasionally express concern about. There are now more than 500,000 more settlers in the West Bank than there were at the beginning of the century. So there have been no brakes on Israel, and the policy is bipartisan to coddle it. But that doesn't mean that Europeans whose people are mobilized and outraged by this just disgusting cruelty and inhuman campaign that Israel has launched to starve an entire population, to wipe people off of the map, basically, to put them in places where there's no support for them, no infrastructure. They're being concentrated in Rafah now, where Rafah was destroyed despite the World Court's direction. not to launch an offensive in Rafah. What happened to that? May 24th, over a year ago. That was a red line for Biden. And the World Court was explicit that there should be no offensive in Rafah because it would create a humanitarian catastrophe. I mean,
it's sad to say, but it sounds like you'd need some force, some military force to go in and stop them.
Yeah.
Sad, you know, as that is.
Yeah, it's true. And there could be, you know, a Berlin airlift type of operation. You know, could we imagine that countries that have air forces that have the ability to deliver?
And then would the Israelis shoot them down?
Yeah, would they shoot them down and provoke, you know, increase chaos? I mean, it seems like chaos is their friend, right?
Yeah.
They're like, we're the crazy people. Don't do anything to us because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, they're trying to, I guess, from their point of view, seize the moment. They're going into Lebanon and Syria to sort of clear everything out that they don't like and make sure that they have dominance. And they don't realize it could backfire because I guess they're pretty super confident at this point. Do you get that sense?
I think Iran like did remind them of their mortality. There were hits in Tel Aviv, like directly on the headquarters of military headquarters there. And they hit Haifa port. And I think that it's costing them a lot. But that said, these are plans that are longstanding in Israel. I mean, I'm sure they have multiple contingency plans, but there's a movie called The Settlers where Ben Gavir's chief of staff actually is interviewed. He's like overlooking the West Bank, and he's saying, we want sovereignty, Jewish sovereignty from the river to the sea. And he says, and I don't mean this river, I mean the Euphrates. So there's long-standing plans of the greater Israel that these, you know, Bible thumpers are driving the region into chaos for. And, you know, there are many religious Jews also who I think are opposed to this, who are outraged by it. And, you know, Peter Beinart's book, Being Jewish After Gaza, I think is what it's called. But it was a great book. I read it and recommend it. So there are many people who are, you know, religious and disgusted by this as well. But there are crazies. There are the fundamentalists, and like to see them confronted more in their thinking and their ideological foundations.
Yeah, I mean, in Israeli society, there's confrontations based on domestic concerns, like, you know, when they attack people for working on the Sabbath, something like that.
Yeah.
But not so much when it comes to, or hardly at all when it comes to the Palestinian issue.
Yeah, there are hundreds of thousands of people on the street because of the Supreme Court issue,
yeah.
Netanyahu, and a tiny fraction would mention Palestinians. You know, Omar Bartok just gave an interview on Democracy Now! A few days ago, and he's talking about how Lemkin, the person who coined the phrase genocide, how he was, you know, thinking about it in the 30s, like what is a word for this? What is how to develop this legal concept, which he finally, like, I guess, perfected or wrote a book about in 43. You know, Omar Bartov says there was no, you know, it took him a while to come around to calling this a genocide. And it's like Lemkin was thinking about this in the 30s for a reason. Jewish people, there were anti-Jewish laws in the 30s. The Genocide Convention, you know, people say, oh, there's not enough people have been killed. You know, it's like the Genocide Convention is for the punishment of all sorts of genocidal acts. And those acts include the incitement to genocide, which far predates October 7th. The erasure of Palestinian existence comes at the founding of the state. I mean, there's soon after that, you know, I mean, there's an erasure of villages, you know, and a refusal.
Or even before. Yeah.
Even before. Yeah, there's no people there. There's no that and then all of the book and the ideological infrastructure of, you know, land without a people for a people without a land, all of those lies that a lot of Zionists were built up on, their belief in the state. So what Lemkin was getting at is that, you know, the foundation for the physical destruction of a group is built by the refusal to acknowledge its existence in the first place, and then the discrimination, the systemic systematic oppression of that group and the dehumanization of that group. That's been happening a long time.
I remember the historian Benny Morris saying, yes, this horrible stuff happened, but it was regrettable but necessary because he believed in the idea of a Jewish state. And they felt like they couldn't do it to get the majority. So it's like this crazy nationalism. You see it all over the world, but it's just that Zionism is the particular form there.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
I'll mention a negative point, but it's possibly a point of leverage for our movements, which is that it's interesting that Norway, Spain, Ireland, Turkey, and Brazil did not sign on to those 6 action points from the Hague Group. They weren't part of the 12 signatories to those points of, you know, no arms, no delivery of arms using our flag, no transshipment through our territory, you know, not just arms, but also military fuel. And it's interesting that these countries whose people are outraged about what Israel's doing and whose leadership often speaks as if they are, you know, at the forefront of like an action that's going to change things, that they didn't sign on, because I think that they could make a difference. You know, Turkey, Brazil, those countries deliver a lot of energy. 40% of oil coming into Israel comes through Turkey.
And it is possible that Turkey and Israel might clash militarily there, maybe over Syria. Who knows?
I think Turkey's working with Israel on Syria. They don't seem to be at odds.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah. And they...
I always thought that they thought it was more their turf and they don't really want Israel in there, but you think they're kind of collaborating.
I think they're collaborating. And they collaborate in the media by denouncing each other very
okay.
dramatically. They call each other Hitler, Netanyahu, Erdogan.
Yeah.
If Erdogan cared about the Palestinians, he could tell BP that owns the pipeline that they're not going to be able to ship through their territory to a country that's committing a genocide.
So Erdogan might be playing to his own population in a way.
Yeah. He's been under a lot of pressure to do something about the destruction of Palestinians in Gaza, and he's yet to take concerted action. He announced a trade embargo, but this like oil is flowing, and it's an important supply, an important source of supply for Israel. Ireland also has been very outspoken, but they still are allowing overflights. They're allowing one of the bases there. They're allowing military to land, and I believe that those military continue to Israel in a number of those military planes continue to Israel in some circumstances. They also have significant trade with Israel, Ireland, so does Brazil. So I think those countries and Spain and Norway that also continue to trade with Israel that have been outspoken could be urged to take action, to impose an economic embargo unilaterally, not waiting for the EU to come around.
That's attorney and Code Pink volunteer Robert Jareski speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. For KABU Evening News, I'm Hannah Frank.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm here with Underscore's reporter, Nika Bartu-Smith. She's a joint reporter with Underscore Native News and ICT, an independent nonprofit news enterprise. Hi, Nika. Thanks for being here.
Thanks again for having me.
Of course. So one of your recent articles is about Portland's Tribal Relations Office. It's titled, Portland's Tribal Relations Office Was Once a National Leader. What happened? A pattern of neglect has sowed distrust in the city program. So this is an article that you published with Alex Zielinski from OPV, is that right?
Yes.
Nice. So tell me a little bit about what started this really important investigation.
Yeah, so this particular investigation started back in, I think it was October, when Adam Bessenti, the former tribal relations manager, was really abruptly fired. And He had been there for a total of 5 months, and there was a lot of outrage expressed by a lot of community leaders in the Indigenous communities around Portland. Yeah, so I'd actually been following this for a little bit longer than that, because this was once an office of 3 people, and then it was downsized to an office of 1, and then it sat empty for months before Adam Bacenti was hired, and then he was only there for 5 months and swiftly terminated. And so there clearly had been this pattern of neglect, and just it was really unclear what was happening. And so Alex and I decided to team up and work on this story together and really kind of dive into public records and conversations with community and figure out, okay, what's happening with this office, because this seems like it should have been and could be a great thing. And what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell me a little bit more about like when the tribal relations program was started?
Yeah, so the program began in 2017 under the city's government relations office. And basically it came out of conversations with Indigenous leaders, community leaders, tribal nations, really asking for more intentional involvement with Native community and support for the Native community in Portland and in both the urban Indigenous community and the relationships that should be continued to be built and honed in on with Native nations across the state. And so it really came from community asking for this position to be created.
And in your article, you tell the story of Laura John, who's the first person to be in this role, in the director role of the tribal relations in Portland City. Can you tell me a little bit more about her role and what she accomplished in that?
Yeah. So Laura John was actually the second person in the office. It was the first person to whose part-time tribal liaison was Patricia Gibson, who's a citizen in the Comanche tribe. Laura John was the first person to take on the director role, is my understanding. She grew up in Portland, and she did a lot. I mean, I think one of the things that we saw was creating tribal liaison positions in each bureau. And so checking in with those positions and making sure that like these conversations about working with Indigenous folks are embedded in all different aspects of government, right? I know that she led a lot of trainings on educating employees on treaty rights and working with Indigenous folks and like legal requirements on working with Native nations. She also really worked on creating policy and conversations around missing and murdered Indigenous people. And so, and really mandating that Portland Police Bureau recognize that and the unique, really unfortunate realities of domestic violence and sexual assault and harassment that is faced by Indigenous folks.
Right. So what happened to her role?
Yeah. So it's a little complicated. Basically, my understanding is that all of this was happening, and then in the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, really felt like things kind of fizzled out a little bit. Not because of Laura John, but because of like citywide. I mean, I think a lot of these initiatives and conversations got put on hold, not just in terms of Indigenous affairs, although that was a big one, but in terms of a lot of just different conversations across the board. So in 2023, the city hired former Metro Councilor Sam Chase, who's not Native, to lead the Office of Government Relations, which is where this tribal relations manager and department had been housed. When he was hired, Laura John was on medical leave for knee surgery and also stress related to her job. So she returned in mid-April, and on her first day back, she got put on a performance improvement plan. And so really, she really feels like she was forced out of her job, because really a couple months after that, she left. And yeah, Chase basically informed John that she'd be laid off if she didn't return from medical leave, and she accepted a severance payout. And then the office sat empty for months before, I think it was about 5 months later, Adam Bacenti came on board, and people were really excited about him from conversations I had had with community members and from being in community. Like, I saw him at every single event I was at, and he was out there building relationships and taking that time to really build trust, because so many Native folks rightfully don't trust, you know, colonial forms of government. And so he was out there kind of building this trust and figuring out, okay, what does community want in a position like this? And then he was fired 5 months into the job.
Why was he fired?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard to say. I mean, I think similarly, Chase pointed to issues with Bassenti, you know, making commitments to tribes without Chase's approval and concerns with Bassenti missing deadlines. And it feels a little unclear, honestly, but basically he was given the choice to step down or be fired, and he chose firing. And he really said that for him, it felt like he had no desire to leave the role, didn't want a severance package, and wanted it to be known that he was not leaving on his own terms.
Right. So where do things stand now?
Yeah, so a little complicated. I feel like that keeps being my answer for everything, but that's really how it feels. In March, the city announced plans to hire a new tribal relations program manager. It's a little different because this position is going to be more narrowly focused on serving as a liaison between the city and tribal governments. And then the plan is that down the line, they're going to create another position that really focuses on engaging with the urban indigenous community. And I think folks have mixed feelings about those being two separate positions. I know that they're kind of gearing up towards hiring, from what I have heard. I can't really say more than that, but it sounds like there is potentially someone that they have their eye on for that role, but nothing has been announced officially yet. And so we'll see.
And through your interviews with these different folks who've had like pretty big roles, what are their hopes for what's going to happen next?
Yeah, I mean, I think really across the board, it's really important to people that the person and or people that are hired have that autonomy to build those relationships and to create timelines of when and what objectives are. I had community members suggest to me having something like an independent advisory board that oversees this position that's outside of the city, right? And that's led by Indigenous community leaders. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I know that there was a request for that. I think really more than anything, it's very clear and an emphasis on like